Today is Thursday, July 22nd, 2010. My name is Meredith Horn, a graduate student of public history and the intern for an oral history project recording the memories of individuals who have significant association with and knowledge of IUPUI. Funding comes from the University Library, the Department of History's Public History Program, and the University Administration's 40th Anniversary Fund, administered through the IUPUI Office of Community Relations. Today I'm interviewing Dr. Gerald Bepko. Thank you for agreeing to this interview again. This is the second of two interviews. We are in the television studio in Kavanaugh Hall on the IUPUI campus, where we are recording using both digital audio and digital video. I'd like to ask your permission again to do the following: to record this interview in both audio and video, to have the interview transcribed, to place the interview and transcription in the IUPUI Special Collections and Archives for the use of patrons, and to deposit the video with the IUPUI Office of Community Relations for such public relations purposes as the officials in that office deem appropriate. Is that okay?
That's fine.
Okay. Well, for the second interview, I would like to begin with your time as the Chancellor of IUPUI.
As I'm getting into that, can I make one comment?
Yes,
about
of course.
What you did this morning? I mentioned the consolidation of the campus, bringing the Purdue programs from 38th Street. That was my top priority when I became chancellor. And it was not only to bring science and engineering down to the main campus, but it was to solidify the relationship between IU and Purdue. I think that when Purdue was located at 38th Street and IU was located down here, that was not a good use of resources in higher education for this region. And I thought the merger that created IUPUI was a very good thing. I wasn't here when it happened, but when I came here a couple of years later, I thought, what a brilliant idea. And part of that was based on my affection and respect for both institutions, IU and Purdue. Of course, I've gotten an IU paycheck for 33 or so years. I've been very close to people at Purdue. Steve Behring, who was dean of the medical school here, and I were friends, not only because we were fellow deans on campus, but because we were neighbors. One of the Behring sons calls my wife Jean, Aunt Jean. I haven't been very close in recent years because we've been separated. He's been in West Lafayette, but going back many years, I've had very dear friends at West Lafayette, including Bob Ringel, who was the executive vice president for academic affairs at Purdue. Steve recruited him while he was president, and then Bob tragically died several years ago now. But we've made a gift almost every year to Purdue for the Ringel Gallery at West Lafayette. We're members of the Purdue President's Council, which means you donate a little bit of a certain amount of money every year, you get to be a member of the President's Council. And I like to count Martin Jiske as a friend, and especially Tim McKinley, who was chair of the board for 20 years at Purdue, is a very wonderful person. They're all wonderful people, but I've been especially close to Tim. In fact, I played golf with him yesterday, and two other Purdue people.
Yeah.
Rick Kozier, who was dean of the Cranter School of Business until just here in the last month, and Bob Bowen, who was a very patriotic Purdue, a patriotic boilermaker who owns and had operated the Bowen Construction Company here in Indianapolis. All three really wonderful people. I don't want to give the impression that we have an IU and Purdue divide here. I've never seen that. I know there are places where it may exist. We can't agree on everything. But I think that the combination here of IU and Purdue, appropriately linked up with the home campuses, is one of the best ideas in higher education over the last half century. I think that it has the potential to create better offerings here in Indianapolis using the strengths of Lafayette and Bloomington. And it has has the potential to create a three-campus corridor, which we have always thought would be like the research corridor in North Carolina, with Duke, North Carolina, and North Carolina State. It's the idea that when you're playing basketball or football, everybody is a patriot to one's own campus.
Yep.
But when the stakes are high and we're talking about international competition and the economy and the state of Indiana, I think that's when IU and Purdue should be very closely associated with each other, creating as much synergy as possible and trying to envision better ways of serving the country and the state.
Yep, they both represent Indiana at the end of the day.
And they're outstanding universities. And I have an honorary degree from Purdue University.
Really?
So, yes.
What's it in?
I think it's a Doctor of Humane Letters.
Humane Letters.
Most law faculty members get the Doctor of Juridical Science or something like that, or Doctor of Laws,
mm-hmm.
which I have from Indiana University. But Purdue, I was very, very happy about it. There are a few things in my life that I am prouder of than that.
It's funny that you mentioned Dr. Bearing, because I did liberal arts at Purdue, and when I got there, the new building was Bearing Hall. And so I spent all 4 years having classes and everything in Bearing Hall. And then when I got here, I hear the name Bearing thrown around a lot, and I didn't really realize that was a man that did so much.
Right.
But, yeah.
He was a dean of medicine here. He was a physician to the astronauts program in his early life.
Yeah.
He has a remarkable background.
Yeah.
And a nice guy, too.
That's what I hear.
Beautiful family, three sons, and they're all great. Peter, the one that calls Jean Aunt Jean, is the one we were closest to. But John Bearing, his younger brother, and one of our children were friends when they were growing up. We lived close enough to each other so that they naturally, there was some affinity between boys within a certain range of each other in age.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'd like to segue then into when you became chancellor. In IUPUI, The Making of an Urban University by Dr. Ralph Gray, he wrote that IUPUI was at a watershed moment in its development in the 1980s. And as the calendar moved toward the time of Chancellor Irwin's departure, IUPUI was in need of a strong leader, knowledgeable about the city and its unique educational experiment. So let's begin with why you were selected in 1986 and to follow Chancellor Irwin.
Well, we talked in the last hour about the deans, and I was friends with all the deans, but very close to a couple of them. One of whom was Walter Daly, who was Dean of Medicine. And I look back at the history of the campus. The first chancellor was Maynard Hine from dentistry.
Mm-hmm.
Second chancellor was Glenn Irwin from medicine. And I thought that because the medical school played such a huge part in the campus and would for the foreseeable future, I mean, the budget of the School of Medicine is probably larger than all the rest of the campus combined. I thought that it would be good to keep up that tradition of having the medical school dean move over to that job. One of the few times he disagreed with me was over this. He recommended that I do it. And we had a friendly disagreement about who was right. You can see who was more influential in the university now.
Who won, yeah.
He got his recommendation and I didn't. And it was a very friendly, and there were some other candidates, one from Bloomington and one from the University of Houston. But I think that the people here wanted somebody who understood the place better. And they thought the person from Bloomington might know more about it, but didn't really understand it the way Walter Daly and I did. And the person from another university, I don't think, was somebody they thought that would be able to learn it, to learn the culture here in time to do something before retirement. So I got the short straw, and it all happened very rapidly. The search was going on all year, but they didn't reach their conclusion about who to offer the job to until right I was in Boston when it happened.
Oh, really?
And I was at a meeting of an organization I've been affiliated with for a long time. I'm a life member of the Uniform Law Commission. It's an organization that has responsibility for preparing uniform laws so that the states can enact laws that don't create problems between the states. If you have, most of the important laws are in the business arena, and if you have different laws from state to state, it makes everything more expensive.
Yeah.
And so we have a proposed, I don't know, everywhere I go I see this, but people, all states have adopted at least 40 or 50 of our projects, and some of them more. Indiana is quite a number. We have something to do every year in the General Assembly, but most of my work was in drafting, and not just drafting in the sense that we wanted to figure out how to write something, but we were actually considering all the different options, what's the right thing to do, how can it most serve with the constituencies that are associated with this law, and anyway, I was in Boston at that meeting, and George Pinnell, who was the chair of the search committee, called me and said, "Jerry, I think you ought to do this." And I said, "Well, okay." I couldn't very well say no, but I thought that I had an opportunity to do something more than other people might have because of the views I had developed about the campus and also the people I knew. I had a pretty large number of people who overtly expressed their hope that I would take the job. So I knew that they not only approved, but that I could go back to them and say, "Well, you wanted me to do this, now here's what I want you to do."
Yep.
So I had a little quiver of arrows that I could use. But it did take a while for us to get used to the idea. Gene and I talked about it a lot and said, "Well, if it comes, fine. If it doesn't, that's fine too." But I think we had both decided that if it did come, we would change our lives and take it. And of course, it was a big commitment for Jean too, because she had lots of interests of her own. She gave up a kind of a real estate business that she had been engaged in. It meant that she was working day and night the way I was. She was the person who managed the J.K. Lilly House, Cedar Crest, up on Sunset Lane. Mm-hmm. And because she was the only person who was there all the time, she did a lot to keep up the other house as well, Lilly House. And we were entertaining or being somewhere where we were thinking of ourselves as being on duty, so to speak, three or four or five nights a week for 17 years. Maybe not that often, especially in the summer, things got a little slower. But when we had a night off, we used to say, "What are we going to do?"
Yeah, what do I do with myself?
That's right. But we enjoyed all of it. I think that it wears you down at times, but we always had a way of rejuvenating ourselves and coming back refreshed after a day or two away or after the summers. Even up to the last year, we worked harder than we probably did in the second or third year, because we were interested in what we were doing. We thought it was important work, work that made us feel good about ourselves, and so we didn't slow down. The last day I was on duty, I was in a little different job in the last year, but I was in the office at 5:45. I was supposed to have dinner with Jean and a friend of ours, and they called the office and said, "What are you doing there?" I said, "Well, I've got a few things I want to tie up." They said, it's 5:45 on your last day.
Leave.
Give it up.
Yeah, get out of there. That's dedication right there.
You know, it would be dedication if I didn't like doing it, but I was doing things I like to do, like teach. I mean, I teach now because I like to do it, and I was doing things then that I thought were useful to other people and meaningful, perhaps, to the institution. So I was happy to be where I was, although I did leave and I went to dinner.
You did eventually go to dinner.
And we left town the next morning. out from underfoot. Anyway, when I got to be chancellor, you want to have some questions about that?
Yes. Well, just so that everyone knows that's listening to this, you had you have listed three main goals that you had for when you became chancellor: to increase the funding for IUPUI, which had been low, less on a per capita basis for undergraduates at IUPUI than any other campus in Indiana, to enhance the community's image of IUPUI, and to foster further growth in the undergraduate programs. So did you see those goals as realistic or sort of as symbolic of where you saw IUPUI going?
I thought they were realistic. The one that we have the least control over is the funding. But I think that a number of things have been done that have made it possible to increase the impact. I see the word impact being used all the time now. I think we've increased the impact of the campus and Indiana and Purdue universities by the work that's been done here. I think that we have also raise money.
Raise money, enhance the community's image.
Yeah, the community's image. I think that was doable, and it's been done. Not complete. That work will never be done, but a big change has been made in the way people view the campus here. And it's not because somebody made a great speech or because you had a brochure that looked especially attractive. It's the day-in, day-out good work of the people here. The only way an institution develops real stature and credibility is to have people observing the real work that goes on. Their lives have been touched by something that's happened on campus here. They went to school here. A relative or friend went to school here. They had, through their business, contact with an academic program. These are the things that build the image. The one thing that hasn't gone as rapidly is intercollegiate athletics. We're not really able to compete with the bigger schools. A school with this big an enrollment is still well over 30,000 now. It was approaching 30,000 when I left. A school at large probably should have a better athletic program than we do. The problem we have is that it's so expensive now. And the biggest expense would be a stadium or an arena of some kind so you could play basketball and have other events there. And with all the other priorities, academic priorities, it just doesn't come to the top. And we don't have a donor. You know, sometimes you might get a donor who would say, I want that stadium to be named for me. We don't have anybody who's ever been interested in that, in part because of the other loyalties to athletics programs in the state. If you were a high net worth individual and you wanted to have an arena named, you'd probably go to Bloomington or West Lafayette, although one of them's already been named, Mackey
Arena, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I just think that's one way of increasing the image of an institution that hasn't been developed as rapidly. I think it will in time, but I think probably what will happen is that the rest of the university world will come back toward IUPUI a little bit. They won't have as much money for athletics. Although in the Big Ten, that maybe it's startling how that's going. This Big Ten television network is producing huge amounts of money for the institutions, and it makes them all the more addicted to spending the money they have to spend to be a winner.
Yep.
And I think it's tough for the schools that aren't blessed with a football program that fills 100, and at Michigan, I think it's 108,000 seats now.
Wow.
For every game. That's where they generate most
of
the
fans. Yeah.
Ohio Stadium, you know, at Ohio State is almost the same thing. I think it's just a little smaller. Penn State has a 100,000 seat stadium. In Bloomington, we have a 60,000 or 65,000 seat stadium that's hardly ever filled, except when Ohio State comes.
Yeah.
We used to say that they always took the publicity pictures when Ohio State was there because they had red.
Same colors. Now on September 4th, 1986, you presided over your first faculty council meeting, and it was held in a large law school classroom where you had previously taught classes.
Right.
How meaningful was that? Was it symbolic of this pinnacle of your career to be holding this meeting there?
Well, I don't think many law faculty members showed up. But it was a nice place for me to introduce myself as the chancellor to the faculty council. I was at home, and I felt good about the what I was doing and where I was doing it. So it was good for me, and I think the faculty responded well too. I think I used some self-effacing humor along the way. I'm not sure which of the things I used, but I may have used my allegorical dream, which I've used periodically, where I was playing baseball. I was a baseball player. I did play baseball, and I was a pitcher. But all the batters were members of the law faculty, and they would come up and bat, and if they hit the ball meekly and it was an out, they'd still run around the bases as if they had made a home run. And they came up and batted and just kept batting and batting and batting while I was pitching and pitching and pitching. And that seemed to me to be the role of the dean. I was their sheriff, you know, and pitchers in baseball, I think in the original game when it was invented by Ebner Doubleday, because it was something a little bit like tennis, the pitchers were called servers. They were serving up the ball. So I was a server, and I was serving up for the faculty. But then I had to encounter a new group of batters, much more powerful hitters, and they were the deans of the schools. But I was still serving the deans and pitching, no matter whether they ran around the bases, although some of them didn't run around the bases. I said, Walter Daly of the School of Medicine, who always hit a home run, no matter what I did to the pitch to him, hit his home run, and he doffed his cap and assigned somebody from the dean's office to run around the bases for him. And at the same time, there was a skybox of wealthy medical school alumni cheering.
Yeah.
Only the medical school had skyboxes. Yeah, I built all kinds of things into that, mostly to convey the idea that I was, as dean, I was a servant, and as chancellor, that's what my role would be. In fact, I have done a lot of reading, and when I was involved with the Tobias Center on Leadership Excellence, about different concepts of leadership, and I think the notion of servant leadership is one that is very interesting. I think people who have been through a lot look at these ideas and they say, you know, that's really a fascinating way of looking at what a leader does. It's timeless because you can find biblical references in the Christian religion. I think the other religions as well. Humility and service were part of the approach to showing that there was a better way. And I think that's something that, while it doesn't play itself out in religious terms, even if we are passionate about the university, we don't think of it as a religion as such. There's no deity involved. But it is important, I think, for people to understand how much the role of university executives is the role of servant. That's absolutely clear that the decisions have to be made by a person who has the responsibility. You can't reassign your responsibilities to a group. Right. That would be a disaster. But the idea is that in making decisions and in talking to people about their input into decisions, I think it makes sense to think of the decision maker as the servant, because the students and the faculty and the staff and the alumni are all the ones who have a direct stake in the institution, and you want to take their views into account. And today, in the employment workplace, you have a situation that I don't think was ever present in the past. In a century ago, in manufacturing, they had what they called scientific management. So they would study how people should do their work on an assembly line. You know, they do time and motion studies, and they figure out exactly how to do this, so that you were given a prescription on how you were to do everything. Put your right hand on that, and then pick it up and put it over there, put your left hand on this. You know, it was all automatic. People were automatons, even though they were doing things that probably had some level of judgment. It was very restrictive. But today, in the workplace, you can't do that, because most people are doing work that's so complicated that it's impossible to get a template for everything they have to do. What you have to do is help them understand what their goals and mission are, have them buy into that mission and their values and goals and objectives, and then have them implement them in a way that's philosophically concordant with the organization. The more people that you can get who themselves become servant leaders, if you pass that torch along to people and empower them by doing that, the more productivity that comes out of an organization. And because you've got people who are capable of making judgments at the point of service, and if you try to get directions on that sort of thing, it's not only cumbersome, but it can cause bad decisions to be made too. The people that are on the scene have the best understanding of what it is they're trying to accomplish, what it is they're not making out what they're trying to accomplish, but how to accomplish it. For example, the chancellor of the university has to review promotion and tenure files. When I got a file from a person who was doing cutting edge bench research in molecular biology, and they were on the brink of finding some cure or palliative for cancer, my review of that work was meaningless. I couldn't tell what they were doing. My role was to provide the context and to make sure that they were getting what they needed in order to achieve their objectives. Anyway, this allegorical dream conveys that idea, and I've sort of lived that out as I've worked over the years. Now, servant leaders are not pushovers. You know, everybody who comes in the office, everybody gets their say, but not everybody gets their way. You can't turn decision making over, and you can't be too devoid of a will. You have to be able to exert your will at times. But the environment that it creates, and maybe most important of all, when other people get accustomed to this and they start doing it themselves, they start thinking of it that way, then the whole enterprise seems to rise up. And not always, but I found that this is something that I brought in with me and I took out with me, and was still writing about it even after I went into retirement.
Yeah, you've been very active in advocating the services that not only you can offer, but that an urban university can offer to its region and to all those that are stakeholders in that.
Right.
In the 2000 forward to The Future Is Here, the campaign for Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, you are quoted to have said, "Our goal in the 21st century is to redefine higher education so that it better serves the interests of its stakeholders." In what way did IUPUI start to do that?
Well, I think that we did it through creating partnerships with other institutions. During the 1990s, we created what I think turned out to be the model for helping students find their way into the higher education system, and then giving them a ladder or they could climb rung to rung up to wherever their dreams would carry them. What does that mean exactly? At one time, Ivy Tech and IUPUI and all the universities were separated because Ivy Tech was a community college, but was really a technical college. It was viewed as a workforce preparatory trade school.
Right.
And I think with the campus here in Indianapolis, that wasn't true, even in the early years, but there were a lot of people who thought that was true. And we had a lot of people inside the university who resisted that. I don't think I resisted it, but I was willing to go along with people who did resist their being thought of as more than that. Maybe it was because I went to Wilbur Wright Junior College myself, and I saw what an outstanding institution it was. But anyway, little by little, we thought that all of this was kind of a snobbishness that made people feel good in the university, as we're better than they are, and so we don't want to get involved with them. But it was really hurting students. What we should have is a pathway, and the pathway should be open. It should start where students belong. They shouldn't start at West Lafayette, for example, if they haven't scored well in math and science, or if they haven't got a high SAT score in general and good grades. But we ought to start people in the community colleges. Ivy Tech was evolving so that they could move into the university, so that they felt encouraged to do that. And we started something, a lot of programs. We actually started having meetings every year between all the people who worked at Ivy Tech and all the people who worked at IUPUI on the relationship between the two, how we were facilitating the flow of students, how we were taking students that may have applied here. We thought they were better off at Ivy Tech, so we would give them a passport here. And the passport had on it, has on it, I think they still do this, the courses that they have to take. And if they take those courses at Ivy Tech and get passing grades, then that's a passport right back into admission at IUPUI. So we were trying to find multiple ways together between the two institutions of getting students to be more successful. We created a university college, which was so notable that the Secretary of Education, Richard Riley, came to the dedication of the University College in 1996. For the very reason that we were trying to create opportunity. University College is a place where we house all of the hundreds, at least, scores, if not hundreds, of programs to help people be successful in the university. Now, a lot of failure in the university is not necessary. And we were trying to, one by one, eliminate those barriers that were causing people to fail. When I say fail, they may not have flunked out, but they dropped out. At some point in their lives, it just got to be too burdensome. They weren't getting enough encouragement. They weren't getting enough peer support. They were actually from homes where there was not much higher education. And so they didn't have someone around to say, how dare you think about leaving college? Yeah. It just happened, you know. One day they woke up and said, I've had it. So they got a job, and what a mistake, you know, if you think about it, in the life of any person now who's 45 years old with a high school education or maybe a year of college, the employment market is very dismal. Unless you happen to have a special talent, very dismal. Well, this whole complex of programs, the starting university college, in fact, the person that was the inaugural dean of university college today, I think, was announced as the chancellor of a new college at the City University of New York, CUNY, one of the great, historically great, that's had some problems, one of the historically great urban universities of the country, of the world. The list of people who have graduated from the City University or City College, as he used to call it, is a who's who of important people in the world in the arts, and business, and government. Anyway, he was so good at what he did here, they recruited him out to New York. Scott Evanbeck is his name. This is the kind of thing we tried to do. You say, how are we going to partner with the community? This was a partnership with the community. We We were explicitly taking on something that was not just the university's responsibility. We could take the view, as many do, that we're here, you're out there, we got plenty of you, some of you are going to admit, that's our job.
Yeah.
We screen you out, then we take you in, and then we do our thing. That's not what we thought was important. What we thought was important was to be the engine for the city to have more and more well-educated people. I think you can envision two different Indianapolises. You know, one where the university is aloof, trying to be elite, and one where the university is trying to be excellent, but so open that it's hard to avoid it. And the latter will produce a great city. The former will produce diminishing economy and quality of life.
Yep. Well, do you believe that IUPUI's goal to address the region's educational and economic needs and to improve its health and quality of life has been achieved, or in your time, or if it is achievable?
I don't think it'll ever be achieved because there'll always be more to do.
Yeah.
And health is an important part of this because we are a health university. I think that this in the life sciences will be a very important part of the future of Central Indiana. If we're successful, if we're lucky, and if hard work pays off, then Indianapolis will continue to be a center for the life sciences, and that'll be economically very important for the city. You know, Lilly is great, and Boehringer Mannheim has been here, and you've got a lot of other life science companies here, but they're not strong enough. There isn't a big enough complex. We need to build on that, and if we could double the number of life science jobs there are in Indianapolis over the next 10 years, that would be an enormously important step for the city. And that's what the School of Medicine's doing. All of the research programs on campus are engaged in that in one way or another. And biomedical engineering. Mm-hmm. This goes right up to Purdue, West Lafayette. PhDs in biomedical engineering get their PhDs, or their work is here, and they get them at West Lafayette. West Lafayette won't let the PhD degree be awarded unless the faculty there are directly involved or in some way involved.
Uh-oh.
As they get stronger, they're happier, and it's going better and better. And a lot of these things are developing so that they'll be translatable into economic growth. The best thing that's ever happened in IU-Purdue history was right here in the Purdue School of Engineering and Technology. This happened only about a year ago, but it was something that was in gestation for many, many years. Bill Plater, who I want to mention especially in this conversation, one of the grandest people I've ever met, one of the most talented academic leaders I've ever met, maybe the most talented dean of faculties type person, provost, academic leader I've ever met. Bill was good at identifying faculty members who had work that should be supported. And there was a faculty member, actually was not on the faculty as such, he was in the University Information Technology Services. His name was Ali Jafari, brilliant Iranian, I think. And he worked on something called OnCourse. You probably have seen OnCourse.
Yeah, I use it every day.
This
will be on OnCourse, this interview.
Well, he was one of the leaders of developing OnCourse, but he wasn't satisfied. He went on and developed the next generation beyond OnCourse. Well, the university was a little reluctant to just adopt his new platform as a new generation of OnCourse. For one thing, OnCourse was familiar, people were using it, it was going well, and you don't fix things that aren't broken.
Yeah.
But I think also there was a desire to join a Big Ten network of institutions that were developing a platform of their own. They thought they could use it all across the Big Ten. So Bill said, but this is a great idea. This work is going to be OnCourse on steroids, and it'll be wonderful. So He moved Ali Jafari into the School of Engineering and Technology, where he wasn't a staff member or researcher on staff, but he'd be a member of the faculty, which gives you a little more flexibility. Onur Yurtsev, the dean of the Purdue School of Engineering and Technology, worked with him, and they developed what's called ANGEL, which is the next generation. They started a company called ANGEL, and about a year ago, they sold the company for $100 million to a company called Blackboard. If you're up on the northwest side, and those where Purdue has a building, some activities that come down from Lafayette, their engagement office there.
Yeah.
In one of those buildings there is now Blackboard Inc. That's the company that bought ANGEL for $100 million. It was the largest liquidity event for a startup in either IU or Purdue history. It was right here in Purdue School of Engineering and Technology. I think everybody should be happy about that. But that's what the strength of research may bring, and most likely in the life sciences.
Now, the electronic infrastructure of the campus has been an ongoing priority during your time in office. How did IUPUI and you envision using technology in creative ways that set it apart from the other Indiana campuses?
Well, I think we were among the first to experiment with distance learning. The Indiana University Kelley School of Business started what they call a Kelley Direct MBA. They started it here. They've since moved it to Bloomington.
Okay.
But it was started here, and it was the first really significant, successful, worldwide distance education. People were taking the Kelley Direct MBA program in Europe, in Asia,
wow,
aboard ship in the Navy. It was a program that had very high admission standards, and they had very, very good students. And it was a moneymaker, too, because they charge them a lot of money. All these people are working, whether they're in government work or whether they're in big companies, their employers usually pay the tuition. But there was a lot of that. There was a lot of experimentation with distributed education. We had classes, I think we were the ones that at least played a 50% partnership, and there's maybe a 75% partnership with interactive classrooms where you could have a faculty member in Bloomington, and the classes were located both in Bloomington and Indianapolis. Or a faculty member might be here, and you'd have students at both places. But that was just sort of the beginning, the rudimentary parts. I think that the Center for Teaching and Learning here has been on the cutting edge in many ways of developing learning technologies. Bill Plater recruited a very talented woman who has headed that up, and I can't think of her name right now. But I think the Center for Teaching and Learning has gotten a lot of attention. And of course, most of that is through technology development. There are laboratories where faculty members can go and learn applications. And there's been a lot of encouragement given, a lot of good faculty support work at IUPUI. And I think that we have, through Michael McRobbie's work as Vice President for Information Technology and then now as President, as good a overall IT system as you'll find in any university. Indiana University ranks right at the top in terms of IT infrastructure. We were one of the first to sign a Microsoft contract. I don't think we paid much for it, but it gives every Microsoft product, every student and staff member at IU.
No, it wasn't. I mean, when you first started here, IU electronically and technology-wise was behind, right? IUPUI was mm-hmm. behind other campuses, and so that means there must have been a lot of growth.
I think so.
In a short time.
I think the that. You know, I think on a campus like this, when you introduce the idea, if you're playing defense and you're a campus that already has its reputation, it already has all the things it wants, it's kind of an automatic pilot, you introduce new things, they say, oh, well, wait a minute, we're doing okay right now. we don't want to take any of our energy away from what we're doing and invest it in something else.
Yeah.
But the new kids on the block are always more eager, and that's what happened here, I think. They were more willing to experiment. They were looking for ways to leapfrog, to move ahead without going the long, slow route around.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there was an openness here to, I think there's been an openness here as part of the campus culture. I tried to advance that, but I think it was here already. All I did was encourage it a little more. And in some ways, I was a product of it. So I didn't invent this, but I think the campus is more open to innovation. I think it's a very good personality to have as a university, because universities sometimes are at their worst when they are adverse to innovation. They're looking backward and talking about what a great institution they are.
Yep.
It's a time for reflection for that kind of institution. I'm not saying that's true of any of the campuses that are part of IU or Purdue, but at this place you have much more openness and an enthusiasm for new things.
Now, during the vast changes that were happening while you were chancellor, we got a new library. And regarding the opening of the new IUPUI library in 1993, Barbara Fischler of IUPUI and the director of the library stated, "It's time to give us the budget to fill it." How is your relationship with the state legislature tested or changed with the new when the new IUPUI library was scheduled to open without the proper funding to support basic needs like books and staff? And
well, you can't go to the legislature for every new thing you need. We managed to find the money to support the library. I don't think it was perfect, but it was not a situation where they were left without resources. And I think over the years that's continued. Bill Plater was a champion for the library, and he made a big difference by making the case, not just with me, but with everybody on campus, that this was really an important thing to invest in. He set up the Center on Teaching and Learning in the library building. I think that, libraries will never say they have enough money. It's impossible, because there's always something they can do that would expand their collections and services. But I think the library here has made a lot out of the relatively modest resources that were there at the beginning. And I think it's grown. I think the resource base has grown. And what causes resource bases to grow, most of all, is use. You know, if you've got people standing in line and they say, this is not working because there aren't enough these kinds of services, then you have to get the resources. And that's what's happened over the years. The library gets a lot of use.
Would you talk about why it's so innovative and how it's sort of changed the way university libraries are seen and used?
Could I
talk about it or elaborate on why it's different here?
Well, I'm not so sure it's all that different, but I think that this bubbles up. I think that if there's a lot of energy in the law library, in the library, and if you have lots of people in the academic community saying we need more of this or more of that from the library, then I think you have a kind of undeniable energy that usually results in your finding new resources, taking it away from something else or generating it outside the institution. Sometimes using new money, we usually got some new money from the General Assembly. Not so much in recent years, but for a while there, we were getting a little bit of new money above and beyond what was necessary to adjust for inflation. And we would use that new money in a way that addressed issues like library funding. We also had a tax. One of the things that we did, I thought that made a big difference on the campus, was the inauguration of responsibility center management. In the old system, nobody knew what their costs were because they were hidden from the decision makers. The deans are the ones that held the budget. And all they would see is that, you know, they didn't have anything in their budget for technology, they didn't have anything in their budget for space, they didn't have any, all they had was personnel and maybe supplies and expenses. Yet they were making decisions that involved consuming other resources. Those things were managed by the university. And we said, this whole system is inefficient because the deans were making the decisions about how much to pay the faculty or who to assign to different things to get things done within the schools, how many students we should admit, what kind of income are we going to get from that. All these things were taken away from the deans. And yet they were the crucial decisions that the deans were not making, I guess because they were defaulting on it. The institution was defaulting on it. If you say to a dean, how would you like to increase your enrollment? He'd say, yeah, we could do that. What's in it for me?
Yeah.
In the old days, there was nothing in it, unless you were offered some budget increase if you increased your enrollment. The tuition went right to the university. Now, deans were smart enough to make that argument that, hey, if you're generating more tuition, can't you give me some of that?
Yeah.
But it was not clear that those things were directly related. Could the dean save money? You know, if you've ever been in a big organization where there is no accounting for how you use general services, I always use the example of, we visited a truck assembly plant in the old Soviet Union, and they had a big field full of axle assemblies for the trucks, rusting in the field. And we said, how can you have so many of those? You're not using them. He said, well, they were available. Anything that was free and available, you took. That's the way things work.
Don't need it, but...
Well, you know, if it's free, why not? And that's what happens in big organizations when they don't have the discipline that comes from having responsibility centers. What you're really trying to do is put the decisions and the resources at the same point.
Yeah.
So that a dean can't say, well, I need to have a whole wing of the library set up with books for my discipline. And you don't know whether that decision is based on the fact that he won't have to pay for it, or whether it's based on how serious the need really is, or whether he couldn't meet that need another way. If it's going to come out of his budget, then you know that he's going to think carefully about it because he knows that he can use the money for something else if it's not used there,
mm-hmm.
or she. On the expense side, it's important, but it's also important on the revenue side. You know, we found deans generating revenue they never thought they had before. For example, they had people using equipment in their buildings, or in them using space in their buildings. And when they found out that if they could charge for it, maybe they get some of that money back, they said, gee, it's altogether different. It was fun when I could give it away, but it didn't mean anything to me financially. But you know, those things should be regulated because we don't want the deans turning their schools into a discount house or something like that, or a low-class motel. But you want to have an alignment of decision-making and resources so that people will make the best use. And I think responsibility center management in the first few years proved itself because enrollments went up significantly. Because deans recognized that if they had more students, they were going to generate more revenue. Not all of it, because the university takes taxes out of it, but a significant amount of that revenue would come right to their budget. After they were at it for a while, they discovered another thing. Up until that time, they all said, we're working hard to get more students to graduate. But the fact was, they had a lot of first-year students, quite a few second-year students, fewer third-year students, not many fourth-year students, and even a smaller number graduated. We said, look, you get the revenue for these students if you can help them go from year one to year two, and you keep 20% more than you did this year, you won't be spending a penny more on your faculty or on your classroom work, but you're going to get more student revenue. And you go to the third and fourth year where they have very small classes because there aren't that many majors in some fields. You'll get more students there and you can have the same classes, same faculty teaching, and you'll have more revenue. And I think that created an incentive for people to say, you know, we have a we not only have a responsibility to do this, but it's in our best interest.
Yeah.
They knew they had the responsibility all along, but it meant more to them when they could see some benefit to their budgets. I think the responsibility center management was initiated here first, and then went to Bloomington. Right now, I'm not up to date on this, but as of the time I retired, just a year or two before I retired, they had a faculty review. This is usually the death knell of university programs. You know, if the faculty wants to review something, you can bet somebody wants to kill it.
Yeah.
They had a faculty review of responsibility center management, and they came out enthusiastically endorsing it.
Really?
Yeah. And I think that's the kind of thing universities have to do in the future. And I don't want to get ahead of where I am. I'm only going to talk about what I did, but I think just this one thought, it occurred to me back then too. Universities of the future will be a lot better at managing their costs. They'll be innovative, they'll be creative, they'll do things in different ways, they'll measure student outcomes so they know they're getting a good product. They're not poorly educating people just to get their money. It's going to be a good outcome, but they're going to spend a lot less money on each student to educate them. And the institutions that were in the business of doing that, when we did responsibility center management, that was one of the reasons we did it. I think the students that think, institutions that think carefully and clearly about that will emerge as the best of the higher education institutions 25 years from now, because there's a lot of money that's spent in higher education that is of questionable value.
So where's the money coming from other than tuition from, you know, it's coming from the state, but how does it come from the state, I guess, the money?
There's a state appropriation for Indiana University,
mm-hmm.
and then each of its campuses has an appropriation. Actually, the appropriation comes to the campuses, but it's under the authority of Indiana University. And you get an appropriation, that's your base appropriation, and that you could do pretty much with what you wish. I think on this campus now, it probably makes up about 30% of the budget. So you get about 30 cents on the dollar comes from the state, 25 cents, 30 cents on the dollar comes from tuition, and the other comes from other activities, endowments, philanthropy. I left a big one out, research income.
Yeah.
Grants and grant income is probably 20%. Or more. But those numbers are hazy in my recollection. But the state's appropriation used to be a much larger part, but over the years, the costs of higher education have gone up and the state support hasn't kept pace with it. When I went to Northern Illinois University, it cost $90 a semester. When I went to Wilbur Wright Junior College, I think it was free. Charge you anything. They charge you a registration fee or something, but there's no tuition. It was like an extension of high school, but only in terms of the tuition, free tuition. Today, because state appropriations have lagged behind, the public universities have all gone to the tuition income as a way of generating more resources. And I think they've gotten to the point, though, where it's becoming very problematic. You know, even here at IUPUI, where we offer the least expensive four-year degree program, I think, of the major publics, because we don't have to provide housing here. You don't have to live on campus in order to be here. Most people find other living accommodations over here. They have family here, join in with some of the people they know.
Family, yeah.
Do you have family in
here? Yes, yes.
So that makes it a lot cheaper for you to come here to
Yes,
school.
It does. Okay, we'll take a short break.
Okay.
All set.
I want to follow up on one thing when I got on that digression about costs and all.
Mm-hmm.
I meant that mostly to highlight that I think that was one of the things that has been done, and why we've taken a look at that. Responsibility center management is one way of addressing that. I think it was a good way to address it, sort of set it in motion, and you may not do everything or anything very significant from year to year, but it's a process, and it creates a culture of thinking about costs and thinking about how you can save money on the expenditure side, how you can generate more income on the income side, and having the people who are in those decision-making positions have the incentives that go with either to save money on the expenditure or make more on the income side. And I think that up until the time I retired, I think that was still out there and kind of fermenting, and people were learning more about it. It isn't something that happens all of a sudden, but the whole culture was more conscious of these income and expense ideas. And that's the thing that I think higher education hasn't probably paid as much attention to, in part because they're so segmented into schools and departments, and they, you know, so many of the goods are free goods that they get from on high, from the central administration, like the axles came from some other part of the Soviet manufacturing enterprise.
Now, since responsibility-centered management has made it more efficient to manage expenditures and money coming in, has there been a change in financial aid offered to students and bringing in students that maybe otherwise cannot afford to come to school without a little bit of extra financial aid? I know you talked earlier about how it was difficult to get some students to come to law school, for instance, if they didn't have the money because the law school couldn't offer scholarships. Has that changed since you've come?
Yes, I think, well, I worked on it, but I think Charles Bance has made more progress on this. They have been able to set aside more money for scholarships, and I think that's terrific. I don't think it was because we didn't want to do it. I think it was because we just didn't have the flexibility. There were so many other things that were more urgent, or seemed more urgent at the time. I was delighted. I've always given money myself for scholarship programs. We created, I think, three or four different scholarship programs on campus under the family money. I'm not a high net worth person, but we give every year to keep building up the endowment for these scholarships. And then when I retired, they created the BEPCO Scholars Program, which is endowed by the university mostly. I've given money to that too, but my gifts haven't made even a small part of that. But there is more scholarship money available now, more financial aid available now. I think we're always good at providing loans, as most universities are. But I think that was something that we were dealing with on a more ad hoc basis. It wasn't something that we could say, yes, we started here and we got to there. I think Charles Bance has done more of that. But we did create scholarship programs where we could, and we had a little money we could see our way clear. We talked to donors about scholarship money all the time, and we created a series, pretty steady stream of relatively smaller funded scholarship programs. But at least somebody may get a couple $1,000 a year out of a scholarship program. And I think you can endow something at, I think the payout rate is around 5%. So if you give $50,000, you can get a $2,500 a year scholarship. And I think there are more and more of those.
Now, since you've been with IUPUI for such a long time, and it's such a position that you worked a lot with IU Bloomington, and that you were chancellor of the university, how did you see the relationship with IU Bloomington change from 1986 until you left?
You know, I don't think there was an institutional pattern that evolved. It really was more based on the individuals who were president. John Ryan was one person. John Ryan created the office here in Indianapolis, the vice president office that I talked about before, and the Wilburn plan for management of higher education, the system schools and core campus schools, and the core campus expression was invented by the Wilburn committee and adopted by the trustees in 1974. So John was one person to deal with, and Tom Ehrlich came aboard, and Tom, I think, understood the need for the close relationship between Bloomington and Indianapolis, and he taught up here. Tom taught in the School of Liberal Arts, I think. Taught, of course, once in Bloomington, and then he would teach in Indianapolis, go back and forth. And Tom tried to create some new ways of looking at this, but I think his approach was a little different than John Ryan's. I think Tom loved the campus life in Bloomington. He was probably the most intellectual of the university presidents over the years. Interestingly enough, he did not have a PhD. He was a lawyer, but he was really a person of the arts, and he was a person who read widely. He would see his reading lists, and he would be comfortable with the intellectual community. But I think that the relationships stayed pretty much as they were, with a little personality difference here and there. I think Tom may have spent a little less time in Indianapolis. John Ryan spent quite a bit of time here. He worked the legislature pretty well. Miles Brand carried the tradition forward, and he created this strategic plan that involved all campuses. And so everybody was involved in the strategic planning process, and that made a difference. I think more IUPUI people were brought into that. I think it may have been in Tom Ehrlich's time or Miles' time, but we went from having co-presidents of the university faculty council to trading it back and forth between Bloomington and Indianapolis, which I think was a change, recognizing Indianapolis as being equal to Bloomington in terms of having a chair of the president of the overall university-wide faculty council. Mm-hmm. The university faculty council never did very much, but it's symbolic and important in that symbolism. And it did relate to the trustees, so they had the ear of the trustees. Miles spent a lot of time up here, and Miles understood IUPUI in a way that I don't think Tom Ehrlich or John Ryan did. John Ryan was a very strong advocate for IUPUI and the other campuses. Right. He was the vice president for the regional campuses before he became president. And so he was a supporter. But I think it was Miles who really understood IUPUI because he had been at the University of Illinois in Chicago, which is very close to what IUPUI is. You've got the University of Illinois, flagship campus in Urbana-Champaign. You've got the campus in Chicago, right downtown, and the medical school is there. So it looks a lot like IUPUI. In fact, I think Charles has kept this up. We used to have meetings up in Chicago of something called CEOs for Cities, and the chancellor at the University of Illinois Chicago was one of the hosts. I got to know a couple of them really well. They turned over. But we saw a lot of similarities, and they were doing a lot of the things that IUPUI has done. I think Miles understood that better, and he was I think a little more open to shifting the relationships between Bloomington and Indianapolis, giving Indianapolis a little more role in things, a larger university. In fact, one time, and this only could have worked if Miles had the understanding that he did, but there was a lot of discomfort over the use of the flagship metaphor, because people in Bloomington kept saying, Bloomington is the flagship, Bloomington is the flagship. I don't think anybody denied that. It was clear, but it was bothering people. They said, well, what does that make the rest of us, you know? Are we tugboats or what?
Yeah.
So when Miles gave his State of the University message up here, and the presidents have alternated between here and Bloomington to give their university-wide State of the University. And when Miles gave his speech, I introduced him, and it may have been after he gave his speech, because I think he may have used the expression flagship in his speech. But we had prepared a t-shirt for him, and it was, cleared the copyright issues. We got a picture of the Starship Enterprise from Star Trek.
Yeah.
And we had it on the t-shirt, and it said, IUPUI, the Starship Campus. And we gave him that t-shirt. And he got a big kick out of it. He said, yes, he said, I understand.
Are there pictures of that, or do you know if there's...
I don't know.
That would be amazing to see.
Yeah, it was... we worked hard on it, too, because we had to get this image without violating the copyright.
Yeah.
And get it on a t-shirt. And but it worked well, because we didn't want to disparage the flagship, but the people who saw it thought, you know, that's interesting, because I know what a starship is, and now a flagship, I conjure up the idea of a 19th century British man of war.
Yeah. Now, you've also been credited with helping IUPUI to create a sense of identity, to bring it together as one unified campus. And you led a movement to unify the various programs of IUPUI academically and geographically by bringing all the schools to West Michigan Street campus and presiding over the construction of more than 20 buildings. So can you talk about your goals when you started construction and started moving buildings to the West Michigan Street campus?
Well, we got started with the science and engineering programs from 38th Street.
Right.
And the next thing was a library, so we went after those right away. And we got them all within the first few years that I was chancellor. I will never forget the role that Paul Manweiler played. He was a student of mine, and at the time he was the Speaker of the House of, or if he wasn't Speaker, he was the majority whip in the House. He was an important role in the House of Representatives. And the Purdue buildings were our number one priority, and I only had, from the summer till about the 1st of December, to work on getting support for the Purdue building, because I didn't take office until, I think, September 1st, and the legislative session is almost underway already by that time. They don't actually start meeting in earnest, but a lot of stuff is going on to get ready for it. They have their organization days in October, November, and then they actually start their sessions in January. But you really have to do your work in advance of that. So we had little time to do it, and I was worried about it because the Commission for Higher Education had recommended against it. It was IU's number two priority, I think. It was the number one priority for this campus, number two overall for the building in Bloomington. I think they had it ahead of it. But the commission looked at it and said, we don't think it's a high priority. You got a nice building up there on 38th Street. Why would you want to move it? It isn't worth it. And so we had to go to work and work on that. And Paul Manweiler said he would be supportive of it. And he had a very important position in the General Assembly. He said many of his fellow Republicans would support it. Even there were some Democrats who wanted to support it, even though I think a lot of Democrats wanted to support it, but it was just the ones he knew. We had already talked to them. But we didn't know what was going to happen until the session was almost over and they hadn't yet filled in the buildings there. They usually saved that to the end. In those days they did anyway. They saved them to the end because they were using them as ways of balancing interests. They'd say, look, I know you'd like to have this law enacted, but I don't think we're going to be able to get to it this year. What if we gave you a building in your district? You know, that's the horse trading that goes on. But Paul was in a position to be delivering those things, and he called me and he said, we're right down to the time when we're making up the budget, and I want to know what your number one priority is. I said, number one priority has to be the Purdue buildings coming down to campus. He said, okay. And the next day it came out and it was in the bill.
Wow.
Thank goodness Paul was in my law class. I could talk to him that way. I think he knew what it was. And then, of course, the other building came right after that. It was once we started the process, and even the Commission for Higher Education got on board and said, okay, we think it ought to happen. But then it was in 1989 when we got the library and the other building for the Purdue. We were really very successful in that session. And that started a kind of a flow of projects, especially in the medical school. We had projects going all the time. I think there were at least 20. I probably could count more than that. Projects, you know, like adding on to a building or renovating, things that were big enough to go to the trustees as a construction project, but I didn't count them as new buildings. But you go around the campus and look at all of the things that we did, which I think made a big difference in the way people view the university. We're talking about all these things, how it's viewed by the public, how the people here view it, how prospective students view it. All those things were influenced by the fact that when you came out here, instead of seeing a sea of parking spaces, you saw buildings, nice buildings, buildings that you'd like to study in.
Yeah.
And of course, the library was a big difference. Because before that, the library was really, for a student body the size of ours, shamefully inadequate.
Yeah.
I don't know whether you probably never saw it.
I only saw the new one.
Yeah. Well, the old one is where University College is. It's a little building that has a courtyard in front of it between it and the Hotel Conference Center.
Right, yeah.
Those two L-shaped pieces of hardware there. And the students have a lot of things out in the courtyard there now. It's become more of a student area, oriented area. That library was so inadequate. It was really built for two-year programs back in the earliest days. It was one of the first buildings to be built, that in Cavanaugh Hall.
Wow.
And it was built in, I don't know when, but it was still an extension. It wasn't viewed as a campus. So it was totally inadequate. What really tipped this for me, and these things are not altogether rational, but what really tipped the scales for me was when somebody asked me, where do I think the students studied most often? And I said, well, I don't know. In the library? No. And I said, well, where? In their cars. You could go out in the parking lot and see students sitting in their cars reading their textbooks.
That's not good.
Yeah. Because there really wasn't much room in the library, and it wasn't very hospitable either.
Yeah.
It was so small. We had, at this time, 23, 24, 25,000 students, and the bulk of them were in the undergraduate programs, and we weren't serving them very well at all. So the new library was built in large part because of a fundraising effort. It was a $32 million project, and we raised $18 million ourselves, and we had the $18 million in hand when we got the state money, so we didn't have to do any more fundraising. And then we added that fountain, the pyramid with water cascading down. That was a result of a gift from Dick Wood, who was the CEO of Eli Lilly at the time. I think that they've enjoyed that, and I think people have learned to like that as a sort of signature for the campus more and more.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, we worked hard on the facilities each session of the General Assembly. I worked with people that I knew and people who were friendly to IUPUI, people who were from this area who were always supportive of IUPUI, and alumni of mostly the law school, but other schools as well. We've had members of the General Assembly study law while they were at the General Assembly.
Yeah.
I think one just graduated last year. It was important to us, and we worked hard on the buildings. And I did this right till the last day I worked, because my last year as an executive with IUPUI was 2003. In the 2003 session of the General Assembly, we got the last of the money that we had hoped to get from the General Assembly for the campus center, which took quite a few more years to get built. But they put aside the last $10 million. We had told them that we would be able to pay for most of it through revenue. And we had some money that we had saved and put it into the mix as well. So we didn't need the whole construction amount. And we were going to raise some more money, we knew privately. But the big chunk of $10 million was added by the General Assembly in 2003. And it was a gift. I said to Charles Vance, yet another gift we're giving you to come in and be chancellor. He was already here. He was very happy about that, because that is one of his signature buildings. He was here when it was built, and he presided at the dedication. And it is really a spectacular building. I don't know if you like it, but...
Oh, yeah, I love it.
Yeah, it is. It makes it a campus.
It's a showpiece. Yeah. That's where I take all my friends when they come.
Yeah. Well, it really makes it a campus. Before that, there was no place you could go to have a cup of coffee. Well, you could go to the conference center, but it
feels like a home base.
Right.
Between classes, or if you need a snack or just talk to friends for your 10 minutes in between classes, is the perfect place.
Plus, you got a walkway over the street now, too.
Yes, it's very nice.
That was something that people in Kavanaugh insisted on. They said, we have to have that. We can't build a building without that. And they were right. Absolutely.
I've heard it called the gerbil tubes.
Gerbil tubes, yeah. Yes.
Would you also talk about your relationship with William Plater and with the building of the library and just all the efforts he put in?
Bill and I worked together so closely over the years. He was dean of liberal arts, and when I was appointed chancellor, and the first year. The executive dean, as was called in those days, was Howard Schaller, wonderful man. And Howard and I talked about it, and I had already made up my mind that I wanted to recruit Bill to be Howard's replacement. And we worked out an arrangement where the following year, Bill came on as dean of faculties, and Howard stayed as executive dean. I told Howard it was to keep one adult among the three of us. But Howard stayed, and he helped us a lot to get things set up. And then he retired, so we were sort of on our own. And Bill worked, I appointed him as executive vice chancellor, not executive dean, as Howard Schaller was. And I think it was... Maybe it didn't happen right away, because the titles weren't all in place at that time. But it was only a short time, and he was made executive vice chancellor. And he was like a provost, you know, another institution. I would have been the president, and he would have been the provost. Although we did a lot of each other's work, we were very good at going back and forth. And I got involved in faculty things, and Bill got involved in community things. So he was... a wonderful colleague. I can't say too many good things about him, because he was wonderful. He is a wonderful person. We're both from Illinois. We used to say that they had to bring people over from Illinois to lead the institution. But I think there is something to this. He grew up in the southern part of Illinois, and it's like Indiana in some ways. They're just rock solid people there. And he's just got all the talent and attributes that you want in a person to be an executive leader of a university. He had a lot to do with the development of the academic programs, new degree programs. He set up the Center for Teaching and Learning. He went around the country. He's very well known around the country. He's been on different boards and things. He has a following around the country. If you go and talk to people in higher education, they'll probably know Bill Plater. He has given very thoughtful papers on tenure and the work of faculty. He writes well too, so his work.
I have read some of his work.
Yeah. So he's got. He was just a wonderful colleague. I can't say too many good things about him. I think the IUPUI we have today wouldn't be what it is today without Bill's work.
He was also instrumental in improving the quality of education and, I guess, student retention.
Yes,
he was. IUPUI.
Right. We put Scott Evan back in as dean of University College, but Bill was always there as his mentor and as his guide. Yeah, Bill put a lot of effort into increasing. Yeah, because it was, you know, we were kind of learning the institution in the early years, and we weren't sure. You know, we had never made decisions like this before that were sweeping decisions about the direction of the institution. But it became clearer and clearer to us that this was the most important thing we were doing. I mean, I may have said it when I took the job, but it reached deep into me as a person and as a part of my thoughts that we had to create more success. And we were not fulfilling our public responsibilities, and we're not going to be as good an institution as we could be if we didn't have better retention, better graduation rates, and more people earning high-quality degrees. I've been doing that right through till today. I'm a member of the Lumina Foundation board, and that's our goal. A big goal is to have a really seismic change in the number of people who earn degrees in the United States by the year 2025. I'm on the Commission for Higher Education here, and one of our big goals is to do for Indiana what Lumina is trying to do on a national level. The Gates Foundation is partner with Lumina. The Department of Education under Arne Duncan they're using our language out of the Lumina documents about the big goal. Everybody agrees that we have to ratchet up the education that we offer and that people succeed at. We're not just offering it. We've got to have more success stories. And if you look at the international data, the OEC data, Organization for Economic Development and Cooperation, they keep track of the percentage of the population that has earned a degree and the number of degrees that are awarded in any given year. And they try to make comparisons. And 25 years ago, the United States was number one. And today, we're number 12 in
really?
This group. Now, some people will argue the data. I don't think it matters that much whether we're 12th or 9th. We should be first.
Yeah.
And this is an evolving commitment, I think, that IUPUI has done very well. At least in this region, has done very well in trying to promote that. I think the retention rates have gone up, graduation rates have gone up. We graduate more people every year from IUPUI. I don't think we've turned back the dial one centimeter in terms of quality. I think they even ramped it up a little bit while we're graduating more. And and Bill was a real force in that arena. I didn't say anything about what I did in my last year. Are you going to more things there?
More things, but you feel free
to. Go ahead, you do yours first.
Well, in the 1990s, computer literacy for faculty, staff, and students became a major goal of the school. Can you tell me in what ways you helped to foster growth in computer literacy, or what role the Chancellor's Office did in the push for computer literacy?
Well, we had the Center for Teaching and Learning, which I think was a major factor in the applications of computer technology. I think we also had a good leader on campus, Garland Elmore, who came out of the liberal arts faculty, on a communications faculty, and led our own campus. I've even forgotten now what we called it. But I think the last name we gave to it was Integrated Technologies, because it occurred to us, this was probably in the around 1989 or 90, it occurred to us that we had so much overlap in the technology arena. And we said, sitting in a room, if you have, you look at the wall sockets, you get one for power, one for telephone, one for computing, and I've forgotten what else we had. We had another one. I mean, we were running lines into every room in the university, and it seemed to us that they were all overlapping. Physically, they were overlapping, but then if you look at the management of those resources, they were overlapping. They were some telephones. What are we doing with telephones? Why don't we move to an internet base? I think maybe they're doing that now, but we were just thinking out loud at that point about how technology could be more effectively and efficiently utilized by integrating it and having it be one office. That's what Garland Elmore took over, the Office of Integrated Technologies. And when Michael McRobbie came in the 1990s, about 97 I think he came, that changed things again, because we went to having something that we didn't have the courage to do before. We didn't think we had the resources to do before. But he and Miles Brand and all of us, we were all participants in this, but it was a university-wide effort to have a life cycle funding for technology. So we went, the money was put aside, painful as it was, we went to life cycle funding. We signed the contract I mentioned with Microsoft, so that everybody can get any Microsoft product free. I think that's still true. Just that infusion of resources made a tremendous difference. I think, well, the proof of the pudding is that Indiana University now gets ranked right at the top. That includes IUPUI, right at the top in terms of computer information technology access and utilization. Now, how well it's going in the classrooms and how much faculty are using it for pedagogical purposes, are they using all of the properties within the information technology, or are they just using it as an extra screen, you know, a place to put their PowerPoints instead of having them on a chalkboard or on paper? I don't know. I don't know how that's evolving now, but I saw some very promising signs. Bill Plater himself used the technology. He was trying to set an example. He taught a class in liberal arts, I think it was a literature class, and he was doing all kinds of things to enhance and build new dimensions into the course. So he was trying on his own. He was working in the Center on Teaching and Learning to show people, even the executive vice chancellor does it.
Now, I know we talked earlier about the idea of serving as leading. Could you talk about why were you so successful as a leader? What was your style of leadership that made you so successful?
Well, I don't like to start talking about things assuming some measure of success for myself. I'm not being falsely immodest. I'm just, it makes me uncomfortable. But I do think that the things that helped me were I brought to the job a vision and a view of what needed to happen here that I think was a good one. And when you have a vision and you have a point of view about the organization, how it should evolve, I think that is a major asset in the leadership. I think that I was able to relate well. I liked the people here. It was easy for me. I mean, I thought spending time with faculty was something I would pay to do, and they were paying me to do it.
And I
loved that. So I liked the people. I enjoyed their company, and I enjoyed their input. And I was always respectful of them for that reason. And I think those interpersonal things, the fact that I loved this place, and I had a vision for it, which is consonant with all of their visions, and that I liked all of them, and they thought that was good because they had been involved with lots of people, not Glenn Irwin or Bill Plater or any of the others I've mentioned, but you know, some deans, department chairs, were not as easy to get along with, and sometimes they didn't have the generosity of spirit that I think you have to work with people. And I think also the notion that that I was a servant, that I knew, as I've said several times when I mentioned this, I qualified it all the time so people don't think I'm some spineless shoeshiner, you know. I made hard decisions, I had to enforce things, I had to assert my will. But I always did this against the backdrop of thinking of myself as a servant. The allegorical story about me pitching to the faculty of the law school and into the deans on campus had meaning to me all through the time I worked. And I think people understood that after a while, and they said, that's interesting, I like that. I think that, I know he's not wishy-washy, I know he's not just gonna do anything we tell him to do. He has an agenda and he's gonna work it, but he'll listen to us because he does think he's serving everybody here, one person at a time, making the institution better and stronger.
Well, as you look back, is there anything you would have done differently that you would like to change?
Well, I don't know. I think I probably wouldn't think of anything specific that I did or didn't do. I think the one thing that might be worthy of some exploration is whether I stayed too long or didn't stay long enough. You know, I still had a couple of years before my retirement age, and I wanted to retire early. And I made the decision to retire pretty much on the spur of the moment. Gene and I talked about it, of course, but I said, you know, I'm getting to the point now where I think I'd probably retire, because if I want to do something in retirement, I should be young enough to get started at it and not have to bury myself in something new in order to get up to speed. So we decided that it would be when I was 63, 1 year before the retirement age, we call 64 the retirement age, under a retirement program that Indiana University has, and 65, which is sort of the norm for administrators in the university. Right now, I think they have a mandatory retirement for executives at 65. I don't know. At different times, it's been observed, at different times it hasn't. But I was thinking about it, you know, maybe I should have gone a little earlier and had more time for myself to get into another life. Or maybe I should have stayed a little longer, a couple of years longer, especially because of the transition we were in. But I didn't know about the transition. When I announced that I was going to retire, Miles Brandon decided he was going to make a shift in his life. And then when Miles resigned to go be president of the NCAA, it was in September, and it was too late to do a search, so the trustees asked me to be the interim president. If I had retired earlier, maybe there would have been a different configuration of things. Maybe if I'd worked longer, it would have been good for me to stay on during that transition to a new president. It might have been good for me to be in office still after that new president came. But I don't think there aren't any big things that I would go back and change. Maybe it's just that I've forgotten all the things that were disappointments. I only remember the good things.
Yeah.
That's how you make 70 into the new 50.
Just remember the good.
Yeah.
Well,
go ahead.
I was going to ask you about your last year, mm-hmm. your last year.
I think it was important for IUPUI because nobody from IUPUI had ever been in the president's office there. In fact, I think there might have been some people here along the way that would have been good, but they would never have been considered because the president either came from afar or from Bloomington. And I think it was another in these incremental changes that were taking place, all of which meant that IUPUI was coming of age. Because I think that a person whose faculty life had been exclusively at IUPUI, except for the time I went to Bloomington to teach as a visiting professor, but that's not a lot. My whole faculty life had been spent, apart from a couple of visiting professorships. I went to the University of Illinois 1 year, and Ohio State 1 year, and Bloomington. But basically, I was in Indianapolis, an IUPUI person. And to have an IUPUI person go into the president's office, even on an interim basis, is something that I think was very good for IUPUI. I think it gave people a sense that, we're in this equally with Bloomington. If not, we're not doing exactly the same thing Bloomington is. We don't have the stature that Bloomington does, but we're not any longer the stepchild. I think it was good for the campus. As I retired, I could feel that there was really a good an environment that people were happy about where they were. They were, we weren't in danger of losing anybody, even though there was a change in the chancellor and the president at the same time. Sometimes that's a precipitating cause for people to leave. But we didn't have anyone that left. And the transition was smooth. Charles Vance has done a good job. So it worked very well. But I think it was not clear whether I should do it. We knew that I was looking toward retirement, and I thought, oh, my God, my last year I'm going to be burying myself instead of taking time to enjoy the things that I had done for 16 and a half years. For 16 years, for example, I told Jean, in the last year we live at Cedar Crest, I'd like us to have one night each week when we go and sit on this little veranda that there was right outside the sunroom, they called it.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been into the house, haven't you? Have you been into the house?
I haven't.
There are two amazing houses up there. One of them is called Cedar Crest. That was where J.K. Lilly lived. He was the Lilly CEO in between the first Eli and the second Eli.
Okay.
J.K. lived there. Mr. Eli, who was the second Eli Lilly and head of the company, was, a widower. And he married... J.K. was a widower. Not sure how this worked. I think they had both been married before. But J.K. bought this house, known as Cedar Crest, which was built in about 1911 by the first radiologist in the community, a physician radiologist. And it was way up in the country. At the time, it was in the country. Now it's right off Kessler Boulevard.
Yeah, okay.
In a street called... Sunset Lane, Crow's Nest is the name of the little town there. It's actually a town. The chancellor of IUPUI always is on the board of the town of Crow's Nest.
Oh.
We used to have town board meetings there. A lot of Lilly people lived on there, Willane, and Dick Wood, who gave the gift for the library and other gifts, was the president of the board of the town of Crow's Nest. We had our town meeting every year. Anyway, J.K. Lilly bought that house in the late 20s, I think. And his father, his son, second Eli, built the house next door called Lilly House. They built that from scratch in about 1928 or so. They're both enormous houses. I think in Cedar Crest there are 33 rooms.
Yeah. That is a nicely sized house, yeah.
And a ballroom on the top floor that's enormous. They built ballrooms in those days. And this is on 33 acres of ground, right in the middle of the city.
Wow.
It's in between Kessler Boulevard, Sunset Lane, and the river. The river borders on the east. Well, we were in Cedar Crest for all 17 years, but during the last year when I was interim president, we had Lilly House, which is the president's house in Indianapolis. When the IU president comes here, he stays in there.
Oh.
He or she stays at Lilly House. And in Bloomington, we had Bryan House, so we lived in Bryan House too. So we had three enormous mansions with bedrooms all over the place. We could have slept in a different bedroom every night. But we made an agreement with ourselves that during the last year, we were going to live in Cedar Crest and enjoy it. And we're going to have a drink before dinner out on this terrace, which I think I did once in 17 years. And then in September this happened, and then as soon as Miles said he was going to resign, the trustees asked me if I would be his successor as interim president. And so all of this went up in smoke. And I was there on the last day, on July 31st, 2003, in the office at 5:45 in the afternoon. Never once did we get out on that veranda. We moved out a little early to give Charles Vance a chance to move in, because Gene was working on moving. We had lived there 17 years. We had enormous collections of things. And it was amusing because we had moved a lot of things that were in university storage into Cedar Crest. For example, when I left the law school, you know, they asked me to do the job in about the 1st of August and start September 1st. And oh, by the way, we want you to move into Cedar Crest too. So Gene did all of that. I went to work on the other things. And the law school office that I had was really a nice office, big, biggest office I've ever had in geographic and in spatial terms. We had bookshelves all over the walls, and all the files I had from faculty days. And I just told Joe McIntyre, who was coming with me. Joe worked for me for 22 years. She stayed with Charles Vance when I retired.
Oh.
But Joe McIntyre was my assistant in the law school. And she said, "What are you going to do with all this stuff?" I said, "I don't know. Please just pack it up and store it." So they packed it up and stored it in the law building. Well, along the way, they needed the space, so they said, "Can we move it somewhere?" And I said, "I don't know where to move it. There's a basement in Cedar Crest. Why don't you move it up there?" So they moved all that stuff. Three big platforms that they use these forklifts to lift up. Three big forklift platforms in the basement there, plus all our furniture, everything else we had moved in, things we bought, because there were 32 rooms.
Right, yeah.
A lot of it was furnished already. Well, we put some of our own furniture in there. We found things we liked that we bought. And we had to move all of that out. Gene did all of that. I didn't do a thing to help. The only thing I would do was answer questions. She would say, "You want this?" I'd say, where will we put it?" She said, "I don't know." I said, "I don't want it." That was how I ended up at 5:45 on the last day. So I didn't really participate much in that. And that meant that we spent a lot of time after we got back to our house. We had two big storage areas in one of these places where they sell rent space.
Mm-hmm.
And getting the stuff out of there. And then we have a basement in the house we live in now that's full still of stuff. We probably would have sold the house already, but we don't know what to do with all the stuff. That's one of the things that I thought, if I had planned a little more, a glide path into retirement, what I was talking about before,
mm-hmm.
it might have been better.
Yeah.
But anyway, if you have any more questions.
Well, I don't have any more questions. Is there anything else you'd like to add or anything I've forgotten?
Yeah, I'm sure we could talk for hours more. I think I've said pretty much what I should say or could say.
Okay.
I just think it's great that they're doing this oral history. I think that these are important. I don't know how many people will listen or read, but it's important to have access to it.
Yep.
People will learn things. I know I listened to the, I think I told you, I listened to the 1989 oral history tapes in the car while I was driving back and forth to the office.
Yep.
And I learned a lot.
Well, thank you for coming.
Thank you.